Welcome to Managing Myeloma. My name is Adam Cohen, and I'm the Director of Myeloma Immunotherapy and an Assistant Professor in the Hematology Oncology Division at Abramson Cancer Center of the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Today I will be discussing relapsed refractory multiple myeloma, standard of care among emerging agents. So before we get into some of the new regimens for multiple myeloma, it's important to go over some basic definitions. The IMWG has set distinct criteria for defining progressive disease, and this can be based either on biochemical progression with changes in the paraprotein, either in serum or urine, or occasionally in the involved free light chains, or progression based on clinical parameters, such as increasing size of bone or soft tissue lesions, new renal failure, hypercalcemia, or worsening anemia. For patients who just meet the progressive disease criteria, this is called relapsed disease. For those who are progressing on or within 60 days of their most recent salvage therapy, this would be called relapsed and refractory myeloma. And this is in distinction from primary refractory myeloma, which describes patients who have never achieved any significant response to prior therapy and represents a very poor prognostic group. Now, in terms of looking at the therapeutic landscape of myeloma, we've come a long way from our original available drugs, namely corticosteroids and classic cytotoxic chemotherapeutics, as listed here. The first new classes of drugs that really dramatically changed the way we treat myeloma were the proteasome inhibitors, and bortezomib was the first in class, and now we have carfilzomib and ixazomib, as well as the immunomodulatory drugs, initially thalidomide and now lenalidomide and pomalidomide. And most recently, we've had two new classes of drugs being approved, namely the monoclonal antibodies with daratumumab and elotuzumab, and the histone deacetylase inhibitors, panobinostat. And by combining these drugs in two and three and now even four drug combinations in initial therapy, we've been able to achieve response rates now routinely above 90% and increasing depth of response as well. But it's become very confusing also, as we have a number of different regimens. It can be difficult to help decide which regimen is appropriate for which patient. Now, when it comes to relapse refractory disease, it's important to take into consideration a few general issues with each patient. And these can be both disease-specific as well as patient-specific. So first, looking at disease-specific considerations, you want to be aware of the underlying biology of the disease for each patient. What were their cytogenetics, LDH, which can be a representation sometimes of the aggressiveness of the disease, and especially how has the disease manifested itself previously. Did the patient have renal failure when they first presented with myeloma? They'd be at higher risk for that at the time of relapse. What's the pace of the relapse, the degree of symptom burden? What kind of response did the patient have previously and the duration of that response? And is the patient now developing extramedullary disease or even circulating disease? And finally, does the patient have an exhausted marrow with cytopenias? This may affect the choice of therapy going forward. In addition, there are patient-specific factors that should be taken into consideration. Most importantly, the comorbidities and or frailty of the patient. What prior therapies has the patient had and how do they tolerate those therapies in terms of toxicity? And of course, what are the preferences and goals of care for the patient, given that this is likely an incurable situation? In addition, it's important to remember that patients who have only slow biochemical relapse without any evidence of worsening symptoms can sometimes be observed initially to get a sense of the pace of the disease. And so you don't have to jump into therapy right away in certain situations. The other thing to keep in mind is that there really is a need to individualize therapy for each patient. We're going to go through a lot of the data from the various clinical trials, but there's really no universal algorithm that states you must use this regimen in line two and this regimen in line three. I think it really has to depend on the patient in front of you. And you can reuse a prior regimen if there was a deep or durable response obtained. Other things to keep in mind, generally once the disease has relapsed, it's going to continue to relapse. And so it's important to consider treating until progression. You can attenuate the dose and schedule as sort of a maintenance after an initial response is achieved. But in general, continuous therapy is probably most beneficial in this setting. And finally, keep in mind this is a very rapidly changing landscape. It seems every few months there's another large randomized phase 3 trial that adds additional regimens to our armamentarium. And so it's important to keep abreast of these changes. Now, this is from the current NCCN guidelines listing a number of the available regimens for relapsed refractory multiple myeloma. This is just to give an overview of a number of regimens that are out there, and we won't have time to go through all of them, but I'll be focusing on some of the ones that are either most commonly used or have recent phase 3 data to support their use. But this is a good resource to refer to. So in going through treatment choices for relapsed refractory myeloma, I've divided patients up into those who have relatively sensitive disease. These are patients who had only 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy and generally are not refractory to bortezomib and lenalidomide. And in this space, we have a number of potential options here, and I've listed a few for you, some of which are based on phase 2 or older phase 3 trials listed above. And then we'll go through some of the more recent phase 3 data, including some of the very recently approved drugs just in the past year. And so the first study actually to demonstrate the value of a triplet, including a proteasome inhibitor and an IMID, over a doublet in relapsed refractory disease was this European study published in the JCO about 4 years ago. This was a very defined patient population. They all had were in their first relapse after an autologous stem cell transplant, and they were largely naive to bortezomib and thalidomide, having received classic chemotherapy-like inductions. This was a high dose of thalidomide used at 200 per day, and it was a fixed duration of therapy. Not surprisingly, there was a large amount of significant neuropathy with the combination of bortezomib and thalidomide. Nonetheless, this trial demonstrated that a triplet can induce a deeper and greater response rate, as seen on the bottom right, and actually met its primary endpoint of increased progression-free survival as well, with a hazard ratio of 0.61. There was a trend towards improved overall survival that wasn't statistically significant. Now, in the United States, we often use lenalidomide rather than thalidomide due to its decreased neuropathic effects, as well as perhaps more potency. And the data supporting the use of bortezomib lenalidomide dex, the VRD regimen in relapsed refractory myeloma, largely comes from this phase 2 study led by Paul Richardson and colleagues at Dana-Farber. Now, this was a more heavily pretreated group than the prior study I just showed, median 2 prior therapies, including the majority of patients having been exposed to bortezomib and thalidomide. It also used what we'd likely consider suboptimal dosing of bortezomib and lenalidomide based on their initial phase 1 experience. Nonetheless, they found a 64% response rate in relapsed refractory multiple myeloma with this combination, with a median PFS of 9.5 months and an overall survival of 30 months. And so while VRD is now being used upfront much more commonly, there's still all patients who have retained sensitivity to proteasome inhibitors and IMIDs where this could be an option for you in the early relapse setting as well. Now, the first of the really new drugs that we'll discuss is elotuzumab. And this was studied in the ELOQUENT trial, which compared elotuzumab lenalidomide dex to lenalidomide dex for relapsed refractory myeloma patients who had 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy. Elotuzumab is an anti-SLAMF7 monoclonal antibody. SLAMF7 is a molecule expressed highly on plasma cells, including malignant plasma cells, and also expressed to a lower degree on other immune cells, such as natural killer cells. Interestingly, there were no single-agent responses with elotuzumab in a relapsed refractory study, but there was significant synergy seen in combination with lenalidomide, both preclinically and in a phase 1-2 study. And so in this randomized phase 3 trial, elotuzumab was added to lenalidomide index and was shown to improve both the overall response rate as well as progression-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.7, as seen here. Further follow-up shows that this PFS advantage is retained at 3 years, and there is now an emerging overall survival advantage with a hazard ratio of 0.77. And importantly, elotuzumab did not seem to add a lot of significant new toxicity. There is some lymphopenia. There is about a 10% risk of infusion reactions. But overall, this triplet combination was well tolerated and seemed to improve outcomes compared with Lendex alone, making it a reasonable choice in this population. The next novel drug we'll talk about is carfilzomib. This differs from bortezomib in that it's an irreversible proteasome inhibitor. It has to be given intravenously, and certainly has less neuropathy than bortezomib, which is one of its advantages. It's important to be aware that there are a number of different doses and schedules of carfilzomib that are out there. The original approval as a single agent was at 27 milligram per meter squared, given as a 2 to 10 minute infusion, And it's important to remember that for the first two doses, you should always start at 20 milligrams per meter squared to minimize first dose reactions and tumor lysis. Subsequent studies, however, have shown that if you extend the infusion duration to 30 minutes or more, you can get in higher doses of the drug, even as high as 56 milligrams per meter squared when given on the classic day 1, 2, 8, 9, 15, 16 schedule. And finally, there have now been a couple of studies looking at weekly carfilzomib and demonstrating you can actually push the dose up to 70 milligrams per meter squared. So it's really key and important to keep in mind which dose and schedule of carfilzomib your regimen is using when you select one for the patient, and make sure you try to match what was actually used in the clinical study. Now, in terms of looking in the 1 to 3 prior line space, this is the ASPIRE trial, which compared carfilzomib lenalidomide dex to lenalidomide dex for relapsed refractory myeloma. This was almost 800 patients with median of 2 prior lines. Most had been exposed to bortezomib, only 19% had seen lenalidomide, and they couldn't be bortezomib refractory. The carfilzomib was given at the 20/27 milligram per meter squared dosing up to a total of 18 cycles. Lenalidomide and dexamethasone were given on the standard dosing with dexamethasone 40 milligrams once a week. And the study did demonstrate an improved overall response rate, including deeper responses with more VGPRs and impressively a 32% complete remission rate with the KRD arm compared to RD. It also met the primary endpoint of improving progression-free survival with a median PFS of 26.3 months versus 17.6 months for Lendex, a hazard ratio of 0.69. There also was a trend towards improved overall survival, although the follow-up was short and this didn't meet a pre-specified statistical endpoint. Now, the other new proteasome inhibitor is ixazomib. This is the only oral proteasome inhibitor currently approved by the FDA. This is very similar structurally to bortezomib. It has a similar backbone and had similar preclinical activity and pharmacokinetics. However, it is given as an oral drug at 4 milligrams once a week for 3 weeks on, 1 week off. And the toxicities are a little different than bortezomib. There's much less neuropathy. There is, however, a risk of rash or other skin toxicity, and there's a bit more GI toxicity with some nausea, vomiting, and sometimes diarrhea. Ixazomib did have single-agent activity in the relapsed refractory setting, but there was a clear synergy and activity in combination with lenalidomide, and therefore this randomized phase 3 trial called Tourmaline MM1 was performed, comparing ixazomib lenalidomide dex to lenalidomide dex for relapsed refractory myeloma. This had a median of 1 prior lines of therapy. Most patients were bortezomib exposed, most were lenalidomide naive, and again, they couldn't be refractory to either agent to get on study. The study did demonstrate a slight improved overall response rate as well as improved depth of response with the triplet combination and did meet its primary endpoint for improving progression-free survival with a median of 20.6 months for the ixazomib Lendex compared to 14.7 for the lenalidomide dex group. Overall survival was not reached for either group and was not statistically different at the time of analysis. So how do we put all these data into perspective? This is a table comparing these different lenalidomide-based triplets in the early relapse refractory setting. These all patients had 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy and were lenalidomide naive and sensitive. And what I've listed here are just a few key take-home points from each study. Number one, that the toxicity or side effects are a bit different for each of these agents, the unique side effects, I should say. In the carfilzomib-based studies, it's important to know that carfilzomib does have a low but real incidence of cardiopulmonary dysfunction. This can include hypertension, dyspnea, pulmonary hypertension, and even frank cardiac failure with an incidence of around 5%. This is largely reversible with the holding of the drug, and some patients can be rechallenged at a lower dose. As I mentioned, the ixazomib can add GI toxicity and a rash. The elotuzumab has a risk of lymphopenia and a low risk of infusion reactions. You can see there also were differences in the complete remission rates between the three groups, with the highest CR rate being seen with the carfilzomib-based regimen. It's important to know, however, that elotuzumab as an IgG-kappa antibody can interfere with the SPEP and immunofixation by showing a band that's actually picking up the elo, not the myeloma, making it difficult to assess for CR. So I think this CR rate of 4% is probably an underestimation. Finally, It's important to note that despite these differences in CR rates, the hazard ratio in terms of improving progression-free survival over the control arm was pretty similar across all three studies, suggesting a fairly similar magnitude of benefit. You'll notice that in the ASPIRE trial, the control arm had the longest PFS compared to the other two studies, suggesting perhaps that the patient populations were a little bit different. And finally, that the overall survival has really not been statistically different in either of the studies, although there are some early trends that are emerging and further follow-up is needed. So I think really any of these are very reasonable approaches for the patient with 1 to 3 prior lines who is still sensitive or naive to lenalidomide. Now, the other approach in relapse refractory disease is a proteasome inhibitor-based backbone. And so the ENDEAVOR study was actually a phase 3 trial comparing a bortezomib and dexamethasone control arm to high-dose carfilzomib and dexamethasone. So interestingly, still a doublet, but increasing the carfilzomib dose up to 56 milligrams per meter squared, given as that 30-minute infusion, as mentioned earlier. And this was treated until progression. The bortezomib was given on the day 1 for 8-11 schedule and could be given intravenously or sub-Q. And the carfilzomib arm actually had an increased overall response rate, including increased depth of response with greater VGPR and CRs. As expected, there was less neuropathy with the KD arm compared to the VD arm. There was a higher rate, however, of hypertension and congestive heart failure, as shown here in the table. The study did meet its primary endpoint in terms of increasing progression-free survival with an impressive hazard ratio of 0.53, so almost a doubling of PFS. Median overall survival was not reached, and the hazard ratio was 0.79, favoring the carfilzomib arm, but this was not statistically significant. The other recent phase 3 study that builds on a bortezomib dex backbone that has been published just in the last few weeks in the New England Journal was this CASTOR study, which added the monoclonal antibody daratumumab, an anti-CD38 antibody, to bortezomib and dexamethasone. And this also was for patients with at least one prior therapy. The median was 2 priors. Most had been exposed to a proteasome inhibitor and an IMID. They could not, however, be bortezomib refractory in order to get on the study. The bortezomib and dexamethasone were given at standard dose and schedule for a total of 8 cycles. The daratumumab arm was given at the standard 16 mg per kg dose. However, this continued until progression in the dara-bortezomib dex arm. And what you can see on the table is that there was an improvement in response rate, including a near doubling of the VGPR or better rate, as well as the CR rate with the DVD arm. There was some increase in myelosuppression with grade 3-4 thrombocytopenia and neutropenia higher with the DVD arm, but total rates of infections were not different between the two arms. And the study did meet its primary endpoint of increasing progression-free survival. You can see on the curves on the right that the DVD arm had a median PFS that was not reached compared to 7.2 months in the control arm for a hazard ratio of 0.39. And when they did a subgroup analysis, it seemed like the greatest PFS benefit was seen in patients who had only had one prior therapy with an even greater hazard ratio and magnitude of benefit. And this raises a question of whether we should be using daratumumab a little earlier in treatment. I'll be speaking in a few slides about single agent daratumumab studies that led to the FDA approval of dara, which currently is only approved for patients who have 3 or more prior lines of therapy or a dual proteasome inhibitor IMID refractory. And so right now, the FDA has not approved the use of daratumumab in earlier lines of therapy, but I think we'll have to see after these data are submitted if something changes. Okay, moving on now to somewhat more resistant patients. We know that once patients have had 3 or more prior lines of therapy and particularly have become resistant to both a proteasome inhibitor and an IMID, that their prognosis traditionally has been poor. This is the off-cited study from Kumar and colleagues from published in Leukemia 4 years ago, showing a median event-free and overall survival of only 5 and 9 months respectively once this happens. And unfortunately, patients tend to either respond or have stable disease for short periods of time and then progress. And this is likely due to altered biology of the disease. With clonal evolution, patients can become oligosecretory or have light chain escape. They can also start to develop extramedullary disease or plasma cell leukemia, which can be a very difficult problem. And I'll just mention that in some of these cases, once the disease gets out of the marrow, you may need classic cytotoxic agents, VD-PACE, infusional cytoxan, And some of the older drugs can sometimes get these under control for a short period of time and provide a bridge to other therapies. So what's available in this more heavily pretreated resistant relapsed space? I'll first talk about the MM-003 trial, which was a randomized phase 3 study of pomalidomide and dexamethasone versus dexamethasone. Pomalidomide is a third generation IMID that has been approved based on these data. This was a more heavily pretreated population, median 5 prior lines of therapy, almost all refractory to lenalidomide, and 3/4 dual bortezomib lenalidomide refractory. So very tough population to treat. Pomalidomide was given at 4 milligrams for 3 out of 4 weeks, and dex was given 40 a week in the pom-dex arm. The dex control arm was the old-fashioned pulse dex of 4 days on, 4 days off. And the study demonstrated improved response rate of pom-dex of 31%, with improved duration of response and met its primary endpoint of improving progression-free survival. There also actually was an overall survival advantage for the pomalidomide dex arm as well. Pomalidomide, like lenalidomide, can cause myelosuppression and cytopenias, and there was an increased rate of cytopenias in the pom-dex arm, as well as a slight increased risk of infections as well. That's something to keep in mind. Now, I've mentioned that carfilzomib was previously approved for relapsed refractory myeloma, and pomalidomide dex, as I just showed you, has a response rate of about 30%. Given the known synergy between proteasome inhibitors and IMIDs, this phase 1-2 study was started, a multi-institutional study of carfilzomib pomalidomide dex for relapsed refractory myeloma. Again, a very heavily pretreated population, median 6 priors, almost all dual refractory to bortezomib and lenalidomide. And in this case, the maximum tolerated dose in this setting was carfilzomib at 20/27 per meter squared, with POM at 4 milligrams and dex 40 a week. Toxicities were significant, including cytopenias in a significant proportion of patients, and about 19% discontinued due to an adverse event. There were 2 deaths on the study that were possibly treatment related. However, the response rate was about 50%, including 16% VGPRs, which compares favorably to the response rates of either single-agent carfilzomib or POM-DEX, suggesting there might be some synergy between this triplet. And the median progression-free survival of 7 months and overall survival of 20 months was much better than would be expected for this heavily pretreated group. And so even though this lacks phase 3 data, I think this is an option for your patients, particularly those that have become refractory to bortezomib and lenalidomide, where you can regain a response by using these drugs together. Just watch for increased cytopenias and toxicity. Next, I'll talk a little bit more about daratumumab in the more heavily pretreated setting. There were actually 2 studies of daratumumab. First, a phase 1-2 looking at identifying the optimal dose, and then a second study that initially compared 8 mg per kg to 16 mg per kg and found 16 mg per kg to be superior, and then had an expansion at 16 mg per kg. You'll recall that daratumumab is given initially weekly for 8 weeks, then every 2 weeks for eight doses, and then goes to monthly for maintenance. There is a long infusion with daratumumab due to risk of infusion reactions. It can take 7 to 8 hours with the first infusion, but then can be given somewhat more rapidly thereafter. These were very heavily pretreated patients, median 5 priors, 95% refractory to a proteasome inhibitor and an IMID, and 31% refractory to actually bortezomib, carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and pomalidomide. The main toxicities were fairly modest cytopenias. Infusion reactions are seen in 40 to 50% of patients, but are largely grade 1 and 2 and can be mitigated by appropriate pre-medications. There were no discontinuations due to treatment-related toxicities, 2 deaths due to infection. And it's important to keep in mind that daratumumab, because CD38 is found on red cells, can interfere with blood typing. So it's important to let your blood bank know that your patient is on daratumumab if you're trying to type and screen them, and you should get a type and screen prior to treatment in order to identify any pre-existing antibodies. The bottom line, though, was that this single antibody had a 30 to 36% response rate in the 2 studies. The median PFS was 3.7 months, and the median duration of response was 7.5 months, with overall survival not reached. So fairly impressive activity in a very refractory population for a single agent with good tolerability. And then the last new drug we'll discuss is pantobinostat. Pantobinostat is an oral panhistone deacetylase inhibitor. There is demonstrated to be significant synergy in combination with proteasome inhibitors preclinically based on nice work done out of Ken Anderson's lab and Dana-Farber. And that led first to a phase 2 study and then this randomized phase 3 study called Panorama 1, which compared bortezomib, pantobinostat, dex to bortezomib and dex for relapsed refractory myeloma patients who had had 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy. The pantobinostat dosing was 20 milligrams given on Monday, Wednesday, Friday for 2 weeks in a row and then a week off. Bortezomib was given intravenously on the day 1, 4, 8, 11 schedule, and the dex was given the day of and day after each bortezomib. After the first 6 months, patients could go on to an attenuated schedule for another 24 weeks. There was a median of 1 prior line of therapy. Most patients actually were bortezomib naive, and they could not be bortezomib refractory to go on study. And the bottom line was that there was a slight increase in overall response rate, including an increase in complete response rate. And the trial did meet its primary endpoint of increasing progression-free survival, which you can see increased from 8 months for the bortezomib dex to 12 months for the bortezomib pantobinostat dex arm. No significant difference in overall survival. However, there was a significant amount of toxicity with this regimen. You can see this on the left. The pantobinostat arm had significant increase in diarrhea, including grade 3-4 diarrhea, as well as asthenia, anorexia, thrombocytopenia, and neutropenia. And there were significantly more patients who discontinued due to side effects, and there were more deaths on study in the pantobinostat arm. And so because of this increased toxicity profile, there was a subsequent analysis that was performed just in patients who had 2 prior lines of therapy and had a proteasome inhibitor and an IMID as part of their previous treatment. And in this subset analysis of 147 patients, the magnitude of the PFS benefit was much greater. And that's shown in this slide here, with a median PFS of 12.5 months compared to 4.7 months for the control arm. And so the FDA decided to approve the drug in this combination just for this subset of patients, 2 or more prior lines, including a proteasome inhibitor and an IMID, because of the best risk-benefit ratio and largest magnitude of benefit. I will say that there are alternative dosing and scheduling that are being explored for pantobinostat. I think some of the toxicity here certainly could have been attributed also to using intravenous twice-weekly bortezomib, which isn't often used anymore, and with weekly subcutaneous dosing, and also with carfilzomib, there may be a better way to use this drug. And so we're awaiting those follow-up studies to improve the safety profile. Moving on in terms of just other options, it's important not to forget about stem cell transplant as an alternative salvage option for relapsed refractory patients. This, I think, is being done a little bit later on now that we have so many other drugs. But certainly if patients had a deep and durable remission after their first transplant, usually at least 18 months if they weren't on maintenance, and at least 2 to 3 years if they were on maintenance, you might want to consider a second transplant to consolidate their response. You would expect about half the prior remission duration. This also can be helpful for patients who have really exhausted marrows and drug-related cytopenias that limit your ability to give salvage therapy. If you give additional high-dose melphalan and fresh stem cells, sometimes they get reconstituted hematopoiesis, and then they can tolerate more therapies or go on a trial. Allogeneic transplant, I think, still has very limited use, but for selected patients, perhaps, who have achieved a second remission or young with very high-risk disease, you could consider it, ideally on a clinical trial. Finally, just to finish up with immunotherapy, I think the PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors have been lagging a little bit behind in myeloma compared to some of the other cancers, but there are now a few studies that are demonstrating perhaps some activity. The single agent nivolumab study in myeloma in 27 patients didn't have any true partial responses, but a number of patients did have stable disease. And based on preclinical synergy with IMIDs, there have been two phase 2 studies looking at pembrolizumab, an alternative anti-PD-1 antibody, in combination with either lenalidomide or pomalidomide, with an overall response rate of 50%, including in patients truly refractory to lenalidomide, suggesting that there may really be some synergy here. You do have to look out for immune-related adverse events, although these were largely manageable with discontinuation of the drug and steroids. And based on this promising data, there are now a number of PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor trials that are underway, both in the relapse refractory setting largely in combination with IMiDs or monoclonal antibodies, and also a few upfront trials that are getting underway as well. So I think in another couple of years, we'll know a lot more about the role of checkpoint blockade in multiple myeloma and whether this is going to be a valid addition to our armamentarium. But this is something I think you could consider using now if necessary and exhausting other options. And finally, just a quick word about what hopefully is coming down the pike in terms of T-cell mediated immunotherapy. Chimeric antigen receptors are a novel type of immune therapy where patients' autologous T-cells are re-engineered to express a unique receptor with the signaling domain of a T-cell but with the recognition domain of an antibody so that they can then recognize surface antigens. And the most success to date with CAR T-cells have been in B-cell malignancies, particularly targeting CD19 with very high response rates in B-ALL as well as in CLL and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And the first data looking at CAR T-cells in relapse refractory myeloma have been published recently by the group at the NCI. These CAR T-cells target a molecule called BCMA, which is expressed highly on plasma cells, including malignant plasma cells. This was a pilot first-in-human study. Patients got lymphodepleting conditioning with Cytoxan and fludarabine, and then a single infusion of their CAR BCMA T-cells, looking at escalating doses. And once they got to the two highest dose levels, they actually saw responses in 3 out of 6 patients. These were fairly refractory patients, one of which is still durable 6 months or more after the single infusion. And this correlated with expansion of the T-cells. Now, there are significant toxicities with CAR T-cells, including severe cytokine release syndrome, as well as neurotoxicity and pancytopenia. And so this continues to be refined, but a number of additional CAR studies in multiple myeloma are now underway. And so we're awaiting further data about the efficacy and safety of this approach. So to conclude, we're fortunate now to have a growing list of options for relapse refractory myeloma, and patients continue to do better and better. I think it's important to continue to individualize treatment based on the underlying disease and patient characteristics. There's still no proven, quote, best regimen, and many times it is somewhat of an empiric choice based on their prior therapies and their toxicities, and you may be going from one regimen to the next. It does seem now from several randomized phase 3 trials that triplet regimens, adding a new drug to a backbone of lenalidomide or bortezomib and dex, is superior to the doublet regimens, and these are generally now recommended in terms of deeper responses and more durable responses in PFS. Think about continuous therapy, not just for upfront patients, but in the relapse setting as well. This does seem to prolong remissions. And always remember, it's important to maintain quality of life. This is an incurable disease, and so dose reductions are key if patients are having significant toxicity. It's better to keep a patient on the drugs longer than have them come off early on due to some severe toxicity. I think there are still a number of questions and challenges. Of course, the optimal sequencing of how we use these drugs, and is there any particular biomarkers that may be predictive of response to one drug or one class of drugs than the other, and a lot of that research is ongoing. I think we're going to be re-exploring the role of 4-drug regimens. I think prior attempts to add classic cytotoxics to a proteasome inhibitor IMiD steroid triplet did not seem to add additional efficacy and just added toxicity, but now that we have antibodies with non-overlapping toxicities, we're going to see a lot more antibody PI IMiD steroid combos, and some of those trials are now underway. I think the role of minimal residual disease testing, which really wasn't an issue in the relapse setting because we weren't getting very deep responses, is now something we might want to reconsider as we're starting to get complete remissions even in relapsed patients. And could we eventually move to some type of response-adapted therapy where the intensity of the treatment is adjusted based on the depth of response? I mentioned the role of immunotherapy, which is really just starting to get tested in myeloma, and whether this will be moved up earlier. And finally, always an issue as we start to combine all these new drugs together is the role of cost and cost to both the patient and the healthcare system in general. And so these are all, I think, future challenges. But overall, the future is bright, and we have a lot more options than we used to, which is really great for our patients. I would like to thank you for viewing this activity. For additional resources, please view the other educational activities on managingmyeloma.com.